everyone. This is another Campfire Conversation. And tonight we're going to have a conversation with Pablo. Now, a lot of us know Pablo because Pablo is actually one of the first 10 members of Basecamp. He's been with us since the very, very beginning. And almost everybody at Basecamp has read Pablo's book that he wrote, Holding On Loosely. And if you haven't read it, we'll send you a link so that you can buy it because it's really a great book. But also our friend Pablo is living in Tel Aviv right now. And as most of us know, there's been all kinds of violence going on, especially just in the last several days. And Pablo has asked us for prayer, and we just wanted to take an opportunity to ask Pablo what is happening and then ask we let him describe how he's handling it and how things are happening. So, Pablo, could you just tell us a little bit about what is going on right now? What is a normal Tel Aviv resident experience?
Well, in the last 2 days, we've had the last 3 days, we had the alarm bomb raid sirens going off. The first day, it was in the middle of the night. And just to give you an idea, we haven't had those here for 20 years, so we all thought it was an ambulance at first.
Oh, no.
And then it was only after I kind of stuck my head out of the window, we live on the sixth floor of an apartment, that we noticed that the alarm was going in and out, up and down in volume. And when that is the case, it means there's a missile coming. So we quickly run into the shelter that we have in our apartment, because most new apartments in Tel Aviv, well, in Israel, will have a bomb shelter within them, each apartment. And
so this is not just a basement. It's a genuine bomb shelter. It's designed to be a bomb shelter.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Which happens to be my little daughter's room. So it has a purpose-made anti-bomb windows that you close, and then obviously you have this huge metal door as well, and you've got a separate oxygen system in there, and you should have some supplies in there in case you have to stay there for obviously a number of hours, perhaps even sometimes days. So we run in there, but this first missile they sent was obviously not guided very well, so it landed in the ocean, so that was okay. The next day, we had another two missiles sent to us. These two did get through. One of them landed in an open field, and the other one was destroyed by this iron dome that the Israelis has come up with. And obviously, we heard the explosion, as the explosion was only about 2-3 miles away from us up in the air. And it was quite an unbelievable explosion. And then yesterday, we had another two missiles thrown at us, and again, the dome intercepted them sort of 3-4 miles away from here. And again, the two explosions were very, very, I mean, just to sort of give you an idea, the metal door on the bunker actually rattled. So
amazing.
These are big missiles. They're not little missiles. So should they have gotten through, I would expect them to do some severe damage to wherever they land. Day before yesterday, when I was driving in the evening, I actually didn't hear the bomb raid. I was driving on the highway, and, you know, when the bomb raid goes off, people pull over, and they get out of the car, and they run to the side of the road, and they obviously try and hide wherever they can. And, of course, I've never been in this situation, so my first impression was how come everybody's breaking down at once? I mean, everybody was pulling to the side of the road, so I'm thinking, this is impossible. Can't have everybody breaking down.
Right.
And I obviously then kind of dawned on me, you know, no, there's a missile coming. So obviously I went to pull over, but by the time I pulled over, the alarm had obviously gone, and it means that the missile was obviously either landed in the ocean or, you know, or obviously it was hit in the middle of its flight. Because obviously Hamas don't have the technology to guide the missile, which makes it actually more dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
Because at least a guided missile hits its target most of the time, which is obviously a military installation or whatever.
Instead
these guys just shoot.
Yeah,
exactly. These guys just shoot to kill people. And
So Pablo, just a minute. From the, I'm assuming that the missile alarm, you know, the bomb alarm or whatever, only goes off when a missile is in the air. Is that true?
Yeah, that's right. We have a minute and a half in Tel Aviv to get into the shelter.
That's what I was going to ask you. So from the moment the alarm goes off, you have 90 seconds.
We have less, actually. When the alarm goes off, usually we only have about 45 seconds, because it means that the missile is already in the air and they can then see that it's coming to Tel Aviv. Because obviously when the missile first leaves Gaza, they obviously, you know, they're throwing 100, 200 missiles a day. So, you know, the flight is different, but also the size of the missile. So
sure.
By the time they, because obviously you don't want to put the alarm on all the time, because then, you know, everybody lives in panic and life just stops. So they have to make sure that it indeed is coming to Tel Aviv. So we realistically have about, I would say, 45 seconds. Usually it is what we have, that we get in the shelter, and after 45 seconds we hear the explosion.
That is unbelievable. I never knew
so,
that. 45 seconds? I'm not laughing. So, I'm just astounded.
Yeah. So, Pablo, tell us about this dome. How does that operate? Do you know anything about it?
Well,
this
Israeli guy started working on this is the third generation, I believe, second or third generation. He started working on these, I think it was in 2004, 2005. And the first generation was 70% accurate, but they obviously wanted it to be better. He was on the TV a few days ago, and basically what it is a rocket. It's about a sort of 200-pound rocket that intercepts the missile, and it goes up to the area where the missile, and when it's very close to the missile, it blows up. And as it blows up, it covers an area of 100 meters, sort of like a circumference of an area. So it basically explodes. So when the missile approaches it, it's directly the explosion from our missile causes their missile to explode in the middle of the air.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, Pablo, but isn't this almost like taking, you know, someone shoots a gun and someone else shoots a bullet at the speeding bullet and tries to hit it? I mean,
yes, but
we're talking about high technology, aren't we?
Yeah, no, I mean, the Israelis, as you know, when it comes to high tech, are ahead of everybody else, but especially in warfare. But because that is such a minimal window, and you can obviously miss the missile, they came up with this idea that they explode the missile in front of the other missile, so they have a circumference of 100 meters, which until now, every missile they've gone for, they've actually shot down. Because, of course, some of the missiles, they can tell if they're going to land in an open field, so they don't bother shooting them down, because, of course, each of these rockets is $62,000. So, you know, we've already shot 300 missiles, so you do your math. You're up against, you know, you're up on the millions already. So, you know, it's a matter of economics. So, they're very advanced, you know. They're working very well. Even the guy who invented it, he said he can't believe how accurate they are. He never expected him to be this good. But, you know, I believe also prayer has a lot to do with that, you know.
Yeah. Wow.
There's a lot of people praying for Israel. There's a lot of people praying for us. And I believe God is, you know, God is obviously helping this thing work properly, you know.
So, Pablo, okay, I'm in the United States. I haven't read the newspaper in a while. Why is Hamas sending missiles over into Israel? It's from Gaza, right? They're in Gaza, is that right?
Yes. Yeah. Well,
so
why now? Yeah, well, it's not just now, it's been for the last 12 years. It's just that Israel only does something about it every 3 or 4 years. Hamas has been sending missiles from the Strip for the last, you know, consistently for the last 8 years. And some days they get up to 80 missiles a day. Now, what they send is called the Kazam missile, which is a very small missile, which is basically, it's homemade. And, you know, I mean, obviously if it hits somebody directly, it will kill them. But if it lands on your car, you know, you'll get hurt, but, you know, you're not likely to be killed. So those are the ones. But Iran is funding Hamas. And Hamas, basically what they are is a terrorist organization that their motto is we love death more than the Jews love life. And their aim is to exterminate the Jewish culture, basically. And so Iran, through tunnels that are built between the frontier of Hamas and of Gaza and Egypt, they feed them the missiles. And the way that Hamas pays for these things is because of the international aid they're given. Instead of giving it to the poor people, they use it to buy weapons from Iran.
Wow.
And Iran has got now people in there, which basically are teaching them how to use these missiles, how to build them there. and obviously teaching them a lot more about warfare and ground battle and combat. And basically, it's a satellite terrorist organization that Iran uses to get to Israel, like Hezbollah up in Lebanon. You know, we're basically surrounded by them. And the thing about Hamas is, you know, Hamas has been doing this. They do this on a daily basis in the south of Israel. This is the first time they've ever actually dared to hit Tel Aviv. And so, you know, this is why Israel is now intensified, because there is an unspoken rule in the Middle East. If you touch Tel Aviv, then the whole might of the Israeli army comes after you. And that's what they're doing, because obviously if they hit Tel Aviv, or they try and hit Tel Aviv, and Israel doesn't respond, then the other enemies will think, well, we can hit Tel Aviv and nothing's going to happen. And that's the last thing we want, you see.
So how is your family handling the extreme pressure of this, of having missiles raining down on them? Even though you have a dome, you still have missiles coming at you.
Yeah, well, obviously, Sam, it's not easy. I mean, Madeleine obviously has grown up here, so she was here when Saddam Hussein was throwing, you know, 5, 6, 7 Scuds every night during the first Gulf War, and she lived through that. You know, it's very difficult. You know, you wake up, you don't know what's going to happen that day. The minute you hear the alarm, you run. You know, if you're not at home, you got to run to the nearest shelter or to the nearest building and climb to the second floor. You know, if you're driving, you got to get out of your car. You got
to
go and find somewhere to hide.
Why would you climb to the second floor? Why would you climb to the second floor?
Because the Israeli army reckoned that that is the safest floor of a building.
Okay.
If a missile hits it, I don't know the exact reason why, but that's what they say.
That's good for me to know. If I ever hear something, I'm running to the second floor.
And so basically, you know, and the problem with a missile is you just don't see it. You don't know where it is. You don't know where it's going. And you only have realistically 45 seconds to get to the shelter. So, for example, I'm coaching tennis. You know, even if I run my fastest, and I'm pretty quick runner, it's going to take me a good 45 seconds to get to the shelter nearest to the tennis court. So, you know, it's not nice. It's not easy. And, you know, we have a little child, you know, we have Gisela. So if this continues to go on, you know, we're obviously going to have to leave and stay out until it either settles down or, you know, or stops, you know.
So, listen, if you feel like a missile's coming down on you, no matter how manly you are, it's scary. I mean, it's got to
be
scary.
Well, you know, the thing is, I'm very much someone who lives very much in the moment. And, you know, it's been very weird. I mean, it sounds almost sick that, you know, I haven't really felt fear. I have felt anxiety for the fact that, you know, you don't know what's coming next, in the sense when the missile is coming, yeah?
Right.
But I don't become paralyzed with fear. And it's something that I believe God is helping me with, because, you know, the first night we had the siren, obviously Madeleine, you know, she went ballistic, because, of course, she started, the memories from the Gulf War came back.
Right.
And that wasn't pretty. And so her fear almost began to invade my heart, you know, and I just felt God say to me, Pablo, it's okay, you know, don't worry, it's going to be okay. And now, it's easy to hear that, but it's not so easy to implement it when you're hiding in a bomb shelter and you're exposed to a missile, you know, and this is not a firework. This is a thing that has the potential to kill you.
Sure, I mean, the steel door is vibrating, so this is the big thing.
And this is an explosion that was 2 to 3 miles away from where I am, in the middle of the air. So imagine when this thing lands.
Right.
Yeah. So, Pablo, you know, born in South America, I've seen you tour the United States. You're just as comfortable here as you are anywhere in the world. I know your passport's from England, and now you're living in Israel. And, you know, part of the question is, you know, what is your country? Yeah, you know, where do you feel most comfortable? And I ask this in the sense of, is Israel your adopted country? Because now it's family, right?
Well, yes but you know, Jeff, I left home when I was 12 years old, so I haven't really had a home. And this is something that I'm still working through with God. You know, I don't know what home is. I've never had a home. For me, home is my heart, that where I fellowship with God. I don't really have, I cannot put my hand in my heart and say, this place is home. I mean, I lived in the UK for 17 years, which is the place I've lived the longest in my life. You know, that would obviously be the first place that I would probably look to be calling home. Obviously, Israel now is home for me. But, you know, I know my life is not, this is not the place where I'm going to spend the rest of my life. So, and because of the way I've lived my life, I've never really settled anywhere, you know, because I've always been on the move, even with my job. So, you know, at the moment, I don't really have home, you know. I mean, this place is slowly becoming home, but when things like this happen, you know, it isn't exactly a place where I want to live, you know. I don't want to wake up every morning or in the middle of the night have to sleep with my window open and sweat because I need to hear the alarm. If I close my window, I won't hear the alarm, and the missile might land in my house and kill me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So have you had any experience of a camaraderie now with the Israelites there, or, you know, Israeli people, because of this experience, having gone through this with them? Do you feel closer to them as a nation?
Yeah, I mean, you know, obviously I feel, I love the Israeli people because I'm learning to love the Israeli people because of the heart God's given me for them. But, you know, again, I don't believe, you know my story, you know this place is very hard, very dark, very dry spiritually, and I don't have a round table to attend. So I'm very much on my own here, you know. So I see this place as a space I'm traveling through, and you know my heart, my heart, I really feel that God is calling us to come to America, you know, and I'm looking towards that next year. And I felt more at home when I was there with all of you guys than I have done since I've come here.
Yeah.
But, you know, because you have to understand that there is like, it's like an ocean for me, whereas here I'm in a desert, you know, so, but it's a good desert. It's a good experience, you know, to be sitting in a shelter and feel Jesus sitting there with you. It's an experience I will never feel in America because I'm safe there. And no one is going to bomb America. Well, at least no one soon. You know, and to just, it's a very weird thing to explain, but to sit there and be fully present and know that Christ is almost like engulfing you with his arms and he's saying to you, it's okay. I got you. You know, in the midst of a missile raining down on you, it's something that perhaps I would not experience if I live somewhere where missiles weren't thrown. So at the same time that it's a very nasty situation, it is also an unbelievable situation. It's almost like it's breaking me, but I'm not being broken by the missiles. I'm being broken by the reality of this protection that I have over my life, which I can neither buy, engineer, or produce myself.
Yeah, wow.
So how are you able to care for your wife and your children in the midst of this kind of thing? I mean, they're scared. You were saying your wife is, she just reminds her of the Scuds from Saddam Hussein.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's not easy. I mean, obviously we pray every day, you know, together. We commit ourselves to God. You know, we go about life. But, of course, when Madeleine goes out with the baby, you know, it's about trust, Sam. I have to trust God. I don't have a choice, really. I either try and control everything, but how do you control where a missile goes?
Right,
I'm not
right,
too sure about that. And I can't control where that missile is going to be fired, where my wife is going to be every minute that I'm not with her. So I, you know, so much of my life I have to trust for. I don't really have, you know, like my daily spiritual bread, as I said, you know, my fellowship, my everything I need. I don't have other people to give that to me. I have to trust God to give it to me. Otherwise, I'll collapse. So I'm in such a vulnerable position that that's probably why the missiles don't really, you know, they just add to the vulnerability I'm used to.
Yeah, wow. Well, that's well said, Pablo.
So what would you say? I mean, so listen, we all have people in our families who have who are anxious about something. You know, maybe our kids are anxious about their grades or scared, or our spouses are anxious about who knows what, about what's going to happen with their kids. What you're in something that where the fear is really tangible. I mean, a bomb could land. What would you say to us are things that we can say to our friends and our families about sort of dealing with fear and anxiety?
Well, you know, fear, I've always said this to people, fear is an alarm. Fear is, it's an alarm that goes off when something within you is touched, that is broken, and is not functioning the way God meant it to be. Now, an alarm is not meant to be the problem. An alarm is meant to tell you there is a problem. And when an alarm goes off, we don't try and fix the alarm. We try and find the problem.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with a lot of us is when the alarm goes off in our lives, we try and fix the alarm, and we focus on maintaining the alarm and trying to keep the alarm quiet. Whereas instead of, we should let the alarm continue to go off and allow God to show us what it is, the reason that the alarm is going off for. Now, when I'm in the middle of a bunker and as I said to you, I don't feel fear.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I've heard explosions and potentially my life is at risk, I don't feel fear. I feel, I don't really know how to explain it. It's almost like an anxiety, but it's not crowded by the fear that anxiety usually is crowded by.
Sure.
I don't panic. That's the word I'm looking for. I don't actually panic. It's very still. We pray, and we sense, you know, we sense the love that God has for us, but also the love that God has for Israel.
Uh-huh.
And even though Israel does not acknowledge Him in the way that, you know, He would want them to, it shows you His unconditional love and protection towards the apple of His eye, which is Israel. You know, it shows you the faithfulness of God, that despite the fact that people turn their backs on Him, He still pursues them, He still protects them, He still keeps them, He still, you know, He's committed. And it shows the commitment that God has towards us, that despite the fact that we might not be the same way committed to Him, He does not stop being committed to us.
Mm-hmm.
And so we sense a real special anointing when we pray, not just for ourselves and for others, and we even pray for the Palestinians, but for Israel itself, you know. And I was sitting, I know this is going to sound sick, but between missiles, I lit a cigar and I went to smoke a cigar outside, you know. I thought, well, you know, I might as well smoke a Cuban and just, you know, you never know. It might be my last Cuban, but at least
that doesn't sound
at least,
sick. That
at least I don't
smart.
Die with any Cubans,
that sounds
any
smart,
Cubans
Pablo.
Have smoked in my house, you know. So I went outside on my balcony, and we just moved to a new apartment that we can actually see the ocean from the apartment. We're not up against the ocean, but we're not too far away. We're about a quarter of a mile away. So I'm sitting there one evening on my own because Madeleine had gone to her parents, and you know, I began to just ask God, you know, God, what is this all about? You know, why is this happening now? You know, why isn't it happening? Why didn't it happen 6 months ago? Why isn't it happening in a year's time?
Right.
And I just felt God say to me, you know, Pablo, it's almost like a warning to Israel. You know, it's almost like I'm trying to get Israel's attention, you know, you know, at the end of the day, you know, I am the answer for Israel, not their military power, not the help that America gives them, not the aid that the UK can give them, not the intelligence mm-hmm. that other agencies can help them to have, even though they have a great intelligence themselves. But I am the answer to Israel. You know, and a time is coming with Israel, it's going to have to turn to me because all the resources and whatever they have isn't going to be enough for them.
Sure.
Yeah.
And, you know, and so, you know, and God just so clearly said to me, and it's going to be okay. Don't worry.
Mm.
And, you know, and I'm okay with that. You know, I don't know how, I don't know how I can trust that when I have explosions going off 2 miles from where I am, and they're not just a firecracker, you know.
Right.
But I'm just becoming used to, you know, when you live in the desert, you're totally vulnerable. You're vulnerable to everything. You're vulnerable to the elements. You're vulnerable to the sun. You're vulnerable to the cold at night. You're vulnerable to the fact that you don't have water. You're vulnerable to the fact that there is no food. You're vulnerable to the fact that you can get a sunburn, that it can kill you. You're vulnerable to the fact that you can burn your feet. You're vulnerable to the diseases you find in the desert, because unfortunately there is, you know, you're vulnerable to being bit by a snake. You're vulnerable. You're just vulnerable. There's nothing safe about the desert. There is nowhere to hide. There is nowhere to feel safe. There is nowhere to be resourced. You have to go deeper into who God is. Otherwise, you die.
Mm. Oh.
That's really something, Pablo. That's great. I mean, I'm moved by it. I'm moved by your picture of the desert being a place where it's dangerous. There's no, you're vulnerable. I love your line, and I'm moved at the way you feel like God is really speaking to you and getting you to just trust in Him.
Yeah,
His love, His care, His protection.
I don't like to say I don't have a choice, because I do have a choice. And my choice is I can buy a ticket and get out of here and go somewhere safe.
Mm-hmm.
And I will maybe eventually have to do that, because that's just wisdom. I mean, we got to use our wisdom. But, you know, I know that my flesh wants to leave in a hurry. But my spirit is almost like saying to me, my heart, my spirit is saying to me, you know, it's okay. You know, like, the darts are flying, the stones are coming down, the missiles, in this case, we're no longer in the Bible times where there were stones and missiles. But, you know, God is, you know, if we cannot trust God in these times, then when can we trust Him?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, so,
yeah.
I, you know, in the desert, God becomes real. You know, God becomes real. It becomes real in the sense, in a way that He doesn't when it's safe.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's almost like the desert awakens a side of you that the safety of everyday life numbs. And when you are in the desert, you become exposed. You're totally exposed, you know. And is that that exposure is what basically puts you in a place of vulnerability. But it is because of that exposure that you're able to see and feel in your heart feelings that you don't feel when you're safe, because, you know, you don't need to feel them. And you're able to see things that you don't see when you're safe, because you don't have to really see them. And you're able to hear things that you don't need to hear when you're safe, because you don't really need to hear them. Mm-hmm. And so it's almost like the high performance, you know, platform to develop God's children is the desert.
Yeah. Wow. Wow. That makes so much sense, obviously, with the placement of where Israel is and where God led them to, right? That was the land that He led them to. And, of course, the spiritual application there for us all is, I think God does that with every man. He opens up a frontier, and He brings you to a place where you're absolutely dependent on Him.
Yeah.
Where all the safety and security and things you used to rely on are gone. And I think it's only then that we punch through into the transcendency of that other realm to get the help to find the help where our help comes from, you know, which, of course, is God.
So,
and, you know,
what do you say to people who aren't living in a desert right now? I mean, what do you say to the person, the middle-class American living in the suburb, and they have a good job and their marriage is going well?
You know, I'm not so sure that a desert is something, it's necessarily something geographical or circumstantial. I think a desert is something very much spiritual.
Mm-hmm.
And even though we live in a suburb and we have a good job, we can still go through the desert spiritually.
Absolutely.
I think the desert is an invitation to journey into the depths of your heart, to discover who you are and what's really in there and who God is in there and within you. And I think we make a choice. You know, often it is through bad situations that we enter the desert, because bad situations expose us.
Right.
And expose side of us that perhaps the safe situation doesn't. However, we don't need to wait for a bad situation for God to expose that. You know, I often ask God, I want you to expose the hiddenness in my heart.
Mm-hmm.
I want you to expose the hardness in my heart. I want you to expose the wounds in my heart. And you know, when that begins to happen, you certainly begin to go through a desert within you, because you start to enter places within you that are not very nice and that are very dry, they're very dark, they're very arid, they're very dirty, they're very embarrassing, they're very unpresentable. And you suddenly leave the good feeling of feeling complete and whole and loved and approved, and it's almost like, you know, you go into this place. So I'm not so sure that the desert is necessarily a circumstantial or a geographical place. I think the desert is more a spiritual experience. And obviously, because God often gets more attention when we go through difficult places than he does when we're going through a good place, then bad places obviously tend to put us or make us more aware of a desert experience. But I'm not convinced, the more I go through life, that we need to have a bad situation or live somewhere bad or have a bad thing happen to us in order to enter the desert. I think the desert leads us to the place where we live the part of our lives that is unprecedented, which is the promised land. And I believe that all that is a picture of what goes within us, you know?
Yeah.
Right, the problem is we like to think that the desert is a place that we go through, and yes, we can go through desert experiences, but it's not necessarily the desert.
Yeah.
I once heard somebody say that the desert is really the place where we come to realize that we need God. And you can have a desert experience when you've lost everything, and you can also have a desert experience when you have everything in the world and you realize it doesn't satisfy.
Right.
You know.
Right.
So,
and you know, when they prayed in Pentecost for the Holy Spirit to come, they weren't exactly in the desert struggling. I mean, they had food, they had shelter, they were living their lives, everything was good. And they still received the blessing of God that you receive when you go through a desert experience. Now, they were going through a bit of a desert experience. You know, Jesus has died. He's gone. You know, the helper that he promised, when is he going to come? What do we do now? I mean, they were pretty clueless. I mean, they were going through a bit of a desert experience. But circumstantially, they weren't exactly, you know, they weren't exactly suffering, you know. And
right.
So, I mean, I don't know if that's a good picture of you understand what I'm trying to say through that, but, and I'm not so sure I understand it myself, you know, 100%, but I do believe that the desert is very much a spiritual experience, like, you know, the dark night of the soul.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it's like, you know, it's something that happens within us, you know. The problem with us is we're so attached to the securities of life and what gives us control and keeps us safe that often God has to remove those in order for us to then become aware of the poverty and the emptiness and the lifeless parts of our heart that are within us, you know?
You know, the whole Old Testament could be summed up this way, that God wanted to take a group of people and bring them to a land. And when he got them there finally, and they lost it through disobedience, the rest of the Old Testament was about getting them back to that land. And of course, the land represents Christ. It's just a picture of Christ. And of course, we know now that he lives in our hearts. It's not so much the land. The place of his dwelling is right in our hearts. But I think Jesus is really comfortable walking around and hanging out and camping in the desert. And he doesn't fear it, you know. And it's a place where everything gets exposed and things become clear. And it's obvious by talking to you right now, Pablo, that things are very clear for you right now in the midst of this desert experience. The life that you're giving to us right now on this podcast is extraordinary. I think you're speaking with more clarity right now than I've heard you in a while speak, and it's incredible to, and that's the amazing thing about the desert experience. It's a walk of obscurity. It's a walk of reduction. It's a walk out of the safe places into the more vulnerable areas, so that you could then rely on God.
Well, you know, God's desire is for us to live from the whole of our hearts. But the problem is often so much of our hearts is taken up with wounds and hardness and pride and whatever, you know, and fear and brokenness. And, you know, the more I walk through the desert, the more I feel Jesus living his life through me, because I believe the more of my heart there's available to me, because in the desert, as I share with you, you become aware, as you just rightly said, and you're able to journey. I mean, there isn't very much to do in the desert if you think about it. You know, it isn't like you can stop for a burger and watch a flick, yeah?
Right.
There isn't really much to distract you. You know, you don't have anything to distract you. So it's a lot easier to focus on the only thing that is available to you in the desert, which is Christ, you know, which is God. And, you know, I know there's a lot more to this, and every day I'm finding something out, very little, but you know, it's a very strange thing, but I feel safe right now, and I feel very, very comfortable, and I'm not scared. I obviously am concerned, because it is not nice to have a 400-pound, 500-pound missile coming down on you, and certainly not down on your family, and especially with a little baby, but at the same time, you know, it's like, okay, God, you know, I can trust you with this. It's okay. You know, you know, the God I'm getting to know, he's trustworthy. I can trust him with this. He's got me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
So, Pablo, in closing, what, you know, you're speaking to a bunch of men around the country, around the world, mostly here, but we also have in Australia and South Africa. What would you just say to somebody? What are you learning? Well, you know, summarize what you feel like God's saying to you again in all of this.
Well, you know, there's so much I can say to that. For me, you know, I'll tell you what I'm learning. I'm learning that so many of our walks are so superficial, and that so many of our walks are very much based on what happens to us and know who we are.
Mm-hmm.
So much of our identities are so based on what we do and how well we do it, as opposed to who we are in Him. And so much of our lives are walked with so many things in place to protect us and keep us safe, often, and prevent failure for coming into our journeys. And, you know, the thing that I am discovering more and more here as I sit with you talking in the middle of Tel Aviv, and there could be a missile coming any minute, is that there is no point in worrying about what's going to happen in the next minute or the next two, that all you really have is the moment and the present moment, and that moment is the place where God is right now. God is not in the next minute or the one after. Yes, he is. Of course, he knows. He's omnipotent. He's omnipresent. Everything you want. But that the tangible presence and the tangible feeling of Christ living through you can only be found in the moment. As I sit on a bomb shelter and I know there's a missile coming where it can be landing anywhere, and we're waiting for the boom so that the dome intercepts it, you know, I begin to feel timeless within a bomb shelter, in the middle of a nation that is not even mine, in the middle of a people that I do not belong to. I am a foreigner in a foreign land, and I'm very far away from what you would call home, but I still feel very safe, and I still feel very much at home, because home is not a place, it's not a country, it's not a community, it's not a city. Home is within your heart, or your fellowship with the living God.
That, Pablo, that is really moving. Pablo, this has been really good. I mean, I feel like you're just giving us a tremendous gift in sharing your life and sharing your heart with us. And you're being so honest and vulnerable, but you're also being so inspiring and encouraging all at once.
Yeah.
I think on behalf of everyone at Base Camp, I just want to thank you. Hey,
yeah.
Pablo, thank you. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Jeff, thank you for sharing in this. And everybody, this is a delightful time to be with Pablo.